questions on that?
I have good news and bad news, or bad news and good news, I guess. The bad news is we will proceed to work through the lunch hour. The good news is, a very excellent good news is, Mr. Carlson tells me that we're all invited for lunch as guests of Verende. Thank you very much.
Right here in this room at the convenience of the commission.
Well, that will be just as soon as we conclude the hearing.
We don't answer to a lot of people.
Ms. Smith, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would call Todd Mattson.
Mr. Mattson, as you know, I'm sure, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Mattson, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Ms. Smith.
Thank you. Could you please state your full name?
Todd Allen Mattson.
And you're also employed by Element Power US LLC?
Yes.
And you're at the same business address as Mr. Kosiar?
Correct.
And what's your position with Element Power?
I'm the Director of Environmental Affairs.
And could you discuss for us just briefly your education and your work history?
Yeah. From an education standpoint, I've got a biology degree from Morehead State University and a master's degree in wildlife ecology from the University of Wyoming.
And as far as your work history, could you discuss
Yes,
that?
My work history, I've been an environmental scientist, regulatory specialist, working on energy projects and environmental regulatory issues for the last 16 years. I've worked for a number of different consulting firms over that time, focused entirely on the energy sector. Worked on my first wind project back in 1997, and I've got about 16 years of experience in the field.
And what's your role with respect to the proposed project?
As Director of Environmental Affairs for Element Power, I provide assistance to all Element Power's project managers in matters relating to permitting or environmental issues.
And could you give us just a general description of the project site from an environmental perspective?
Yes, it's as Mr. Kosiar mentioned, site is located in southwest McHenry County in an area of rolling hills. It's a lightly populated rural area with mixed grasslands and cultivated ag lands with interspersed wetlands.
And what was the overall approach that Meadowlark took to environmental analysis of the site?
Basically take a stepwise approach in looking at environmental issues for our projects. We start with a high level, what we call a critical issues analysis, to review if there's any significant issues or potential fatal flaws associated with the project. If there isn't anything specifically identified during that process, that critical issues analysis will proceed with doing more detailed technical studies, field review of site conditions to help identify any siting constraints or significant environmental issues that should be considered during development. Studies, more technical field studies at the later stages might include wetland delineations, wildlife survey work, cultural resource work. We'll also do studies on related noise and shadow flicker.
And are you familiar with the exclusion areas, the avoidance areas, the selection criteria, and the policy criteria that are set forth in the Commission's rules?
Yes.
And could you please discuss whether there are any exclusion areas located within the project site?
As shown in Table 3.1-1 of the application, there is one exclusion area located within the general project site. That is the prime farmland. There are areas of prime farmland found within the general project area. However, areas of prime farmland were specifically excluded from areas that would be disturbed by the final turbine layout. There are several short segments of access roads and cable runs that the cross areas of designated prime farmland. However, these impacts to the prime farmland would be less than 1 acre.
And could you discuss whether there are any avoidance areas located within the project site?
As shown in Table 3.2-1 of the application, there are two types of avoidance areas present within the project site, historical resources and woodlands and wetlands.
And could you talk about the historical resources first?
Sure. During the Class 3 inventory, there were two potentially sensitive pre-contact archaeological sites that were identified in the project area. These sites have not been formally evaluated but are potentially eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. These two sites were avoided when developing the final turbine layout.
And could you talk next about the woodlands and the wetlands as
right.
well?
The woodlands are primarily associated with the homes in the form of woodlots and windbreaks or farm field shelter belts. According to data from the National Agricultural Statistics Service, only about 4% of the overall project area is deciduous woodlands. The turbine locations identified in our final layout were completely avoiding these areas of trees. Further, we currently estimate that less than 1 acre of woodland would be disturbed by construction of access road and underground cable locations. Prior to construction, Meadowlark would conduct an inventory of trees and shrubs impacted by the project that would be replaced per the commission's requirements.
And as far as wetlands, could you discuss those as well?
Yeah. Wetland delineation surveys were completed in October of this year. Using information from this survey, a turbine layout was developed that completely avoided wetlands. Although the impacts to wetlands from project access road and underground cable locations were avoided to the degree practicable, there are some minimal impacts to wetlands that were considered waters of the U.S. and thus fall under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, as well as non-jurisdictional wetlands, isolated wetlands. No more than a tenth of an acre would be permanently disturbed at any wetland location. And we are currently consulting with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers regarding our wetland delineations and jurisdictional determinations.
Right. And will any significant adverse effects resulting from the location, construction, and operation of the project as they relate to the selection criteria set forth in the Commission's rules be at an acceptable minimum or managed and maintained at an acceptable minimum?
Yes, that's covered in Section 3.3 and Table 3.3-1 of our application.
And were the policy criteria that are set forth in the Commission's rules also considered and utilized to the extent possible when selecting the project site?
Yes, that's covered in Section 3.4 and Table 3.4-1 of the application. We feel the project meets a number of the policy criteria preferred by the Commission and is consistent with the objectives of to be compatible with environmental conservation and efficient use of resources at the site within the state.
And were the factors set forth in North Dakota Century Code Section 49-22-09 considered when selecting the project site?
Yes, a discussion of those factors is provided in Section 10 of the application.
And let's talk about the studies you mentioned earlier that is part of your site analysis, that you do a number of more site-specific studies. Is that right?
Yes.
And could you identify what studies were conducted in connection with this project, and if there are any reports, when will those reports be provided?
So with our initial application, we filed a critical issues analysis report included in Appendix C, and a whooping crane habitat review that was also included in Appendix C. As part of the initial application, we also filed a Class 1 cultural resource inventory, which is in essence a literature review, and that was Appendix D. Subsequently, we've done a number of more detailed environmental studies, and they've been completed, and they were filed in advance of this hearing. These include a site characterization study, a Class 3 cultural resource inventory report, wetlands delineation report, acoustical assessment report, a shadow flicker analysis report, a sharp-tailed grouse lek and raptor stick nest survey report. We've also filing as part of this exhibit microwave beam path FCC assessment report and an aviation airspace report.
And then I'll direct you to what's been marked as Exhibit 8 in the exhibit binder. Could you identify that document for us?
Yes, this is a site characterization study that we had done for the project.
And could you describe the site characterization study?
Yes. The purpose of this study was done to, in essence, characterize the biological resources in the project and determine if additional biological resource surveys were warranted. In brief summary, the report describes general habitat conditions in the project area and recommends a series of additional detailed surveys or studies to better understand wildlife use of the project area.
And this, as you said, was one of your initial studies that was conducted?
Correct.
I would offer Exhibit 8.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 8 is received.
I direct you then to what's been marked as Exhibit 9. Could you identify that document for us?
That is the State Historic Preservation Office Correspondence and Class 3 Cultural Resource Inventory Report.
And could you discuss that correspondence and report for us?
This study was done to identify all historic properties for the project that might qualify for the National Register of Historic Places and or the North Dakota State Historic Sites Registry, and to record information sufficient to enable their evaluation or to indicate what further work is necessary to accomplish their evaluation.
And then what was the results of this study?
In brief summary, this report describes the intensive pedestrian inventory that was undertaken at the turbine locations in all access and utility corridors and describes the cultural resources that were recorded. And as we discussed earlier, that was, or was provided earlier, that was done on a preliminary layout. And so there is some areas that have not currently been surveyed, but our intention is to do that as soon as conditions allow and to file an updated or amended report with the SHPO's office.
And as far as the report that was done, I believe you mentioned earlier that there were two sites that were left unevaluated for eligibility on the National Register of Historic Places. Is that right?
That's correct.
And those two sites have been avoided?
That's correct.
All right. I would offer Exhibit 9.
Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Exhibit 9 is received.
And then I believe you mentioned that this had been submitted to SHPO. Have you received a letter yet as far as concurring with the report?
Not as of today.
All right. And we plan to offer as a late filed exhibit, and perhaps it could be late filed Exhibit 9A, the SHPO concurrence to the report that has been filed.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 9A, SHPO concurrence to the report filed as Exhibit 9. Am I correct in that, Ms. Smith?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is received.
And then I would direct you to what's been marked as Exhibit 10 in the binder. Could you identify that document for us?
Yes, that's our U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Correspondence and Wetland Delineation Report.
And could you discuss the correspondence and the report?
This correspondence was sent to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to receive a confirmation on our jurisdictional determinations, and it included our wetland delineation report itself. And again, that study was done to identify all wetlands within the project in order to avoid or minimize impacts to those wetlands from our project facilities. In brief summary, there are a number of wetlands identified in the project area, some of which are considered waters of the U.S. and fall under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and some of which were isolated and were considered non-jurisdictional. As noted earlier, we are currently consulting with the Corps of Engineers regarding wetland delineation and the jurisdictional determinations.
And I take it that you're able to move forward with the project. There's nothing, you don't expect a response from the Army Corps of Engineers that would in any way prohibit moving forward with the project?
Correct.
I would offer Exhibit 10.
Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Exhibit 10 is received.
And then if you'll turn to what's been marked as Exhibit 11, can you identify that for us?
Yes, this was the acoustical assessment report prepared for the project.
And could you discuss the results and the purpose of that particular report?
Yeah, this study was done on the proposed turbine layout to estimate operating sound levels associated with the project. In summary, the sound levels at nearby noise-sensitive areas, which are residences in the project area, are expected to be between 32.6 and 48.5 decibels. These are at residences of landowners participating in the project. Sound levels at nearby non-participating landowners' residences are expected to be between 32.6 and 42.1 decibels. For your reference, a quiet residential or agricultural area might be between 40 and 48 decimals. As such, these project sound levels associated with the project are relatively low and not expected to result in annoyances to nearby landowners.
I would offer Exhibit 11.
Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Exhibit 11 is received.
And I direct you to Exhibit 12. Could you identify that document for us?
Yes, that's the shadow flicker analysis report conducted for the project.
And could you discuss the report, the purpose of that report, and the results?
Yeah. This study was done to estimate shadow flicker potentially associated with the operation of the project. In summary, this study showed that the residences in the project area would have relatively low levels of shadow flicker, typically just a few minutes a day at most residences. There were three participating landowners that could see shadow flicker levels of over 30 hours a year. Meadowlark intends to work with those landowners to make sure any concerns related to shadow flicker are appropriately addressed.
And you mentioned, let's go back to the analysis itself. Was this a worst case analysis, or could you explain that process methodology to us?
Yes, it was. We made a number of conservative assumptions in providing that analysis. First of all, using the largest of the turbines that could potentially be used for the project, or the one with the longest blades. Furthermore, we assumed that the receptor locations of the residences were, in essence, a greenhouse, so that if there was any shadow actually touching that house, it would it was counted or evaluated as part of that process. Again, that's likely unrealistic in that you'd only have shadow if flicker coming through a window. It would likely be an annoyance if it's coming through a window. And of course, the entire house by using that greenhouse factor is again a conservative way to make that assessment.
And you said you used the 2.3 megawatt turbine as the worst case. Did you also place that on all of the site locations?
Yeah, yep. So again, as Mr. Cosiard presented earlier, of course, that wouldn't be the case in an actual layout. Using the full 66 turbines that we've ran that model with would be a very conservative way to run that assessment.
And you mentioned 30 hours. Is there any standard or federal or state regulation that sets 30 hours as some sort of minimum?
There's not. There's 30 hours is a number that's come out of a number of different review processes being sort of a level that's thought to potentially annoy receptors. There is no official regulatory position on that. In North Dakota or really anywhere in the U.S. that I'm aware of. That is a number that's very little scientific evidence to show that it's, that level would result in annoyances, but it's become a standard that's been widely adopted based on some work that's come out of Germany.
And so if the model were run using the specific turbine that was used and taking into account the actual factors at the site, it would be a lower number is what you're telling me when you're using the worst case scenario.
Exactly.
And have you had discussions with the landowners regarding the results of this report?
We have had some preliminary discussions with their landowners about at least the three that had the higher levels of shadow flicker to just making them aware of the study, aware of the issues. None of the landowners that we've spoken to of the three houses where you'd have the highest level of potential impact, no one was particularly concerned about that issue. As mentioned before, there is a number of options available to mitigate that if it does become a concern. We could plant trees to help screen the turbines in the shadow from that particular direction, or we could just there's heavy shades or something like that could help further mitigate annoyances from shadow.
I would offer Exhibit 12.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 12 is received.
I direct you to Exhibit 13. Could you identify that document for us?
This is the sharp-tailed grouse-like and raptor stick nest survey report.
And what was the purpose and what conclusions were reached in this particular report?
Yeah, based on the site characterization study that we had done for the site, this was a study that was recommended by our consultant. It was done really to determine the extent of sharp-tailed grouse leks and large stick nests that were used in the project area. Based on the study, there are probably three probable lek locations, at least last year, documented within the project area. Additionally, there's four active or likely active raptor nests located in the project area east of State Highway 41. The red-tailed hawks are likely the most common species utilizing these nests, along with Swainson's hawks is another common raptor species likely using these active nest sites. Both of these are common species of the area. There was no federally protected species under the Endangered Species Act or Bald and Golden Eagle Protect identified during those surveys. There was no eagle nests identified within the survey area.
And how will Meadowlark utilize the information that's gathered in this particular study?
It was really done to help us better understand, does this have highly sensitive resources in the project area? And so it was done first and foremost to identify that. Moving forward, since there doesn't appear to be anything particularly sensitive there, we will use the data collected during the pre-construction phase to compare it against post-construction studies to better understand how species, little study species like sharp-tailed grouse, how they might be affected by operation of a wind farm.
I would offer Exhibit 13.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 13 is received.
I direct you to what's been marked as Exhibit 14 in the binder. And we have three different documents here, so could you walk through what these documents are? Because just it's a little confusing with the first one referencing a Dogden Butte Wind project in McLean County. Can you explain how that is actually relevant to this project?
Yes, there was a series of different studies done to look at microwave beam paths and FCC issues. This initial study by Evans Associates was done actually not in our specific project area, but in an area that was under consideration for develop early on in the development process. It's actually located to the southeast of our project area. It's relevant because it does show that there is some microwave beam paths that would come potentially through our project area. So the second study shown in this report is one done by ATDI, and this was an assessment of these microwave communication links and if there'd be any potential interference with the construction of the project. This was done for the project area and found that while there are microwave beam paths in the general area, there is none that overlap the project area and areas where turbines would be located, and so there'd be no potential for interference with microwave communications from the project. The final report was just a quick report done again by ATDI, and it actually references back to the initial report done by the Evans Associates. And because, as you recall, the Evans Associates report did show that there's some potential microwave beam paths that crossed through the project area, this memo just evaluated those paths identified in the original report and confirmed that they're no longer active, no longer used, and so again would not interfere with operation of the new Frontier Wind project.
I would offer Exhibit 14.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 14 is received.
And now if you'll turn to Exhibit 15, could you identify that document for us?
Yes, that's an aviation and airspace report that we had commissioned.
And could you discuss the purpose of this particular study that was done and what was provided in the report?
Yeah, the study was done to assess potential conflicts between wind turbines and aviation or airspace issues. In brief summary, the report found that the nearest public airport is Minot International Airport, that's 23.1 nautical miles northwest of the project center point. Additionally, the report found that a military training route overlies most of the project with floors as low as 400 feet above ground level. Finally, turbines are unlikely to be impacted by air defense or homeland security radars.
And I direct you to the second page of that report, and there's bullet points on that page. Could you discuss what's provided in that second bullet point regarding the military training route?
Yes, it's basically describes the process for the Department of Defense to raise issues relating to conflicts with military training routes. It basically, through the FAA review process, when reviewing the during their obstruction review process, they make various agencies allow for various agencies to comment on that process, and it basically says that if you're not getting feedback during that FAA review process, those agencies are unlikely to have concerns relating to issues of concern. And again, DOD was given an opportunity to review and comment at an earlier stage of this project in our preliminary FAA reviews.
And it sounds like, based on that particular part of the report, that if there was any concerns, the FAA would help the two parties to address the military and the project to address any concerns.
Correct.
I would offer Exhibit 15.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 15 is received.
And in addition to these formal studies that you've conducted, were there any other key site analyses that were done for the project site?
Yes. In preparing some of the key reports, like the early on critical issues analysis and the application itself, we looked at a number of different topics that were included within those reports. Socioeconomics, land use and managed land issues, including consideration of mining, public service and existing infrastructure, human health and safety, recreation resources, land-based economies, soil geology and groundwater, and surface water and floodplains.
All right. And could you discuss Meadowlark's efforts to coordinate with local, state, and federal agencies and entities and officials during the development of the wind project?
In terms of the local agencies, we have reached out to McHenry County and the Bjornson Township regarding their road use and maintenance agreement.
And at the state level, were there, what consultations have been done there?
Yeah,
as well?
There was a number of different letters that were sent out, consultation letters were sent out to the North Dakota Game and Fish Department, State Historic Preservation Office, Parks and Recreation, Department of Health, Department of Transportation, Aeronautics Commission, and State Water Commission.
And some of those letters were provided with the initial application, is that right? That are response letters from those agencies?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And if you'll look at what's been marked as Exhibit 16 in the binder, can you identify that document for us?
This is the North Dakota Department of Health correspondence.
And so was this received after the application was filed?
Yes.
And could you just summarize the contents of this letter for us?
Yeah, the department believes the environmental impacts from the proposed construction of the project will be minor and can be controlled by proper construction methods. In brief, they provided recommendations related to fugitive dust, dust emissions, minimizing impacts to waterways, stormwater runoff, and noise. Meadowlark will follow the Department of Health's recommendations included within that letter that were referred to as the construction and environmental disturbance requirements.
I would offer Exhibit 16.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 16 is received.
And then did you also have communications with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes, we've had multiple communications with the Fish and Wildlife Service this year. We've had two different separate meetings, one on February 24th and one on August 4th. And then we also have had written communication. The initial communication, which was from June 30th, was provided with Appendix E of the initial application. And then here more recently, we received a letter on October 18th that was included as part of Exhibit 17.
Right. If you'll look at Exhibit 17, can you identify the documents that are provided in Exhibit 17?
Right. In addition to the letter from the Fish and Wildlife Service dated October 18th, we also have provided our response letter to the Fish and Wildlife Service along with, that was dated December 2nd, along with an attachment to that letter, which was our avian and bat protection plan.
And could you summarize for us the contents of the initial letter, this October 18th letter from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes, they basically, the Fish and Wildlife Service in this letter basically reminded Element Power of our responsibilities under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, Endangered Species Act, and Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. They raised some concerns regarding the approach that we'd used to study wildlife-related issues associated with the project, and they indicated in that letter that they would encourage us to participate in the Great Plains Wind Energy programmatic EIS, or programmatic habitat conservation plan, rather, that's currently under development. And then they also indicated that because of staffing and other issues, they were no longer able to provide assistance to us in developing the project.
And could you discuss your response letter that was provided also in Exhibit 17 to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Right. In brief summary, we basically assured them that that we would be striving to be in compliance with Migratory Bird Treaty Act, Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, and the Endangered Species Act. We did raise sort of a counterpoint towards their concerns relating to the study approach that we'd used in evaluating this project. In essence, they were pointing back towards some citing guidelines that were developed by a small group of service and other experts back in 2003. We, as a corporate policy, we're now no longer following those 2003 guidelines. There's more recent guidelines that have been developed by a more inclusive group of experts, including the Fish and Wildlife Service, NGOs like the, well, Audubon Society and other environmental expert groups, some state representatives, as well as representatives from the wind industry. These new guidelines, they're referred to as the Federal Advisory Committee guidelines, just came out last year, March of 2010. They really are the latest thinking in the siting process for wind and wildlife-related issues. And so we, as corporate policy, have been following those Federal Advisory Committee guidelines in developing our projects. The Fish and Wildlife Service is currently looking at updating their guidelines, and those new guidelines are actually due out here within the next several months, and they are going to be following very closely the Federal Advisory Committee guidelines and not the 2003 interim guidelines that were provided earlier.
And you've mentioned these guidelines. Are these guidelines required to be followed in order to develop a project?
No, these are voluntary guidelines.
I would offer Exhibit 18, or hold on, 17. Sorry, thank you.
Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Exhibit 17 is received.
You mentioned the whooping crane habitat conservation plan and an avian and bat protection plan. Could you discuss each of those further for us?
Sure. The currently, the industry has come together and is now developing a region-wide habitat conservation plan for whooping cranes and other listed species that occur in the Central Flyway. That habitat conservation planning effort is underway. It won't likely be completed for a couple years now, but Element Power is a participant, one of the member groups, one of the industry groups that's supporting it financially and participating in that process in developing this habitat conservation plan as basically a strategy to address wildlife concerns here in the Dakotas and the Central Flyway. Our interim strategy before that habitat conservation plan is finalized, we have developed an avian and bat protection plan. That document is really intended to memorialize our commitments to how we're going to avoid, minimize, and mitigate for wildlife-related impacts associated with the project. And it's actually something that's not, again, it's a voluntary plan. We think that the risks to protected wildlife for this particular project are quite low, but nevertheless, we want to have this plan in place to show that we're making all reasonable efforts to conserve wildlife associated with the project, wildlife and wildlife impacts associated with the project.
And if you'll look at what's been previously marked as Exhibit 18, can you identify that document for us?
Yes, this is a revised Section 9.0 of the Certificate of Site Compatibility Application. It's basically our permit and approval table.
And does that provide an update of those particular permits and approvals that are required for the project?
Yeah, yes, it does. It's an updated version of the table that was provided earlier.
All right. I would offer Exhibit 18.
Mr. Armstrong.
No objection.
Exhibit 18 is received.
And based on your study and review and the exhibits and testimony and all of the analyses that have been conducted with respect to the project, will the location, construction, and operation of the proposed facilities produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota?
Yes.
And are the proposed facilities compatible with the environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources?
Yes.
And will the proposed facility locations minimize adverse human and environmental impacts?
Yes.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Judge. I'd like to start off talking with you about the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Survey Service. Are you expecting any further communication from them?
No. They had indicated in their letter to us back from October that they're no longer able to provide us any sort of consultation services. I actually spoke to one of the staff people there after that letter came out briefly, and because of workload, because they're not required to consult with us under any sort of formal process. This project does not require like a formal Section 7 consultation under the Endangered Species Act or formal Section 10 process. They're not required to consult or provide any sort of feedback to us. And so that because of their workload issues, they're simply at this point not going to, at least according to them, my last communication with them.
And can you tell me substantively what's the difference between the 2003 guidelines that they wanted you to use versus what's the newer ones as you referred to them?
The newer guidelines are much more inclusive in terms of, much more thorough in terms of their approach to evaluating project impacts to wildlife. It describes a much more stepwise approach to analyzing wildlife impacts. The original 2003 guidelines called for a comparison of different sites is to be done, and is this basically looking, is a particular project site better than someplace else? And that's really doesn't consider some of the key things from a wind developer standpoint on what it takes to build a viable wind energy project. You need a number of different resources. You need to consider a number of different resources, including wind, transmission, available land, and not just wildlife. And those 2003 guidelines were really very very focused in on just simply wildlife, and didn't weren't realistic or practical from the wind developer standpoint. And so the 2010 guidelines that were developed in a much more collaborative process, engaging many more stakeholders, is a more realistic approach to from the developer's perspective, but also from a wildlife protection standpoint.
And what methods will be used to help protect wildlife if this wind farm is approved?
Well, there's the Avian and Bat Protection Plan is really, again, captures the various commitments that we're making as part of this project to avoid, minimize, and mitigate for wildlife impacts. I think that the plan actually is on par with anything else that's probably been done in North Dakota in terms of conservation measures. Certainly with other projects, one of the most significant issues that many of the projects in this region are faced with is construction within the Whooping Crane Migration Corridor. And as part of that plan, we describe how we're we've identified risk and evaluated risk to whooping cranes. Is there areas of potential stopover habitat where whooping cranes may be coming into use? We describe our approach to having monitors on site during the initial years of operation to ensure that they're not there's not cranes that are using the actual project area, and stopping turbines if they are coming within proximity to turbines. It also talks about, because the latest science are really suggesting that the cranes are actually avoiding these areas of wind farms. They're flying around them. And so so because of that avoidance now, there's a recognition that the cranes are being displaced from habitat that they potentially could have used in the past. And so what we've done is we're recognizing that we're trying to offset our project impacts by creating a conservation offset. And so just yesterday I was speaking with Ducks Unlimited about how we might provide for conservation of whooping crane in other parts of the state. And that's all described again in the Avian Bat Protection Plan.
And then, as I understand Mr. Cozier's testimony, construction is intended to begin in the second quarter of 2012. Looking through the correspondence, you know, the agency is typically asked to avoid the breeding season, what they say, February 15th through July, or February 1st through July 15th. Are there any measures that will be in place on the project to either avoid the breeding season or lessen any impact on the breeding season for birds?
That is something that is sometimes done to do pre-construction surveys to identify certain sensitive species in particular. That is something that will be done particularly relating to raptors. But there was no plan to do a broader survey for nesting grassland species, for example, because of the fact that we could end up spending a tremendous amount of money and cost on to protect species that are really quite common. And so that's something we've not currently offered up as part of our Avian Bat Protection Plan. If the Fish and Wildlife Service feels that that's problematic, they've been given a copy of our plan, presumably would comment on that plan.
Has the Fish and Wildlife Service provided any comment on your plan?
No, not yet.
I'm looking at a letter now, I guess, from the SHPO office dated August 17th, 2011, and one of the things they recommended in there was a Class 2 survey for standing structures in the visual area of potential effect. Has a Class 2 survey been completed?
No, we did not do a Class 2 survey.
Why not?
We didn't believe that the structures found in this landscape would involve, would be impacted by the presence of turbines.
Why wouldn't they be impacted?
Because of the nature of the structures in this particular location, they're not influenced necessarily by the aesthetics of the overall landscape. And so so it was our feeling at the time not to do that. That being said, there were certainly structures identified within the Class 3 survey, historic structures identified within the Class 3 survey. So it was combined, there was some combination of that, although again it was focused in on the project footprint and not a much broader area of the landscape.
Can you just tell me what the Class 2 survey is?
It's my understanding that Class 2 survey is a focus on historic structures, buildings that may have historic significance.
Do you know what structures they're talking about in their letter?
I don't know off the top of my head, no.
I guess what I'm wondering is, I've got a letter from the State Historical Society saying you should do a Class 2 survey, and I understand one has not been done. I'm unclear why we wouldn't want one to have been done if the Historical Preservation Office wants it done.
Yeah, if that's the feeling of the Commission, we certainly review that issue and provide a Class 2 survey report as part of a subsequent filing.
talk a little bit about the noise study for a second. It's, I believe, exhibit. Eleven. Was there any noise analysis conducted with respect to the substation?
No.
Would the substation have more or less noise than the turbines?
Less.
And then with the shadow flicker, you discussed the participant owners being some three houses, I believe it's M, H, and O, as you guys have identified them, having over 30 hours per year of potential shadow flicker. And as I understand, both the noise and the shadow involve the noisiest and the largest turbines for shadow. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What types of things would be done to lessen the impact of shadow flicker?
There's a number of different options available. Probably the two most realistic are if in fact this shadow provides an annoyance to the landowner, the things that we could do would be plant some screening vegetation so they're not seeing that shadow. The shadow is being blocked from that particular direction of the turbine, or the direction where you're getting most of the shadow from. Additionally, just providing additional shading perhaps to the windows of the house.
And as I understand, all those houses are participating owners?
The three houses with the highest level of shadow flicker are participating landowners, yes.
Nothing further.
Mr. Moreau.
I guess following up on that shadow flicker mitigation, just for the record, would that be at the company's expense?
Yes.
Okay. Also for the record, in case the Army Corps of Engineers does require any permits, those will be obtained prior to construction?
Yes.
Okay. In Exhibit 15, which is the Aviation Airspace Report. One of the bullets on the second page says turbines are likely to impact weather radar operations and wind turbine electronics. Further radar impact may be advisable. Has that been done, or is that covered in some other study?
Typically, no, and there was no other study that was done specific to radar issues. Typically, if there's some sort of radar conflict that would come up as part of a project, the radar operators are given an opportunity to comment during the FAA process, the FAA review process, similar to the DOD process I discussed earlier.
Okay, so that would be included in that late filed exhibit?
Yes, presumably if there is any concern relating to weather radar, that would come up during that process.
Okay.
The FAA is not a late filed exhibit.
Oh, it isn't.
It's it's a permit to be filed in the ordinary course.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But let's be clear about that.
Yes.
Okay.
That was our intent. It would be filed along with any other permits.
Okay. I have nothing further.
Questions from the commission? Commissioner Clark?
Just a couple. The acoustic survey, as I understand it and read through it, there were separate surveys done for each of the different turbines that might be chosen. Is that correct? So it encompassed the whole waterfront of the turbines that might be selected?
That's correct.
Okay. This may have been left open as an open-ended question from Mr. Armstrong's questions regarding the SHPO recommendation, so I just wanted to circle back on it. But in case there was any question, I think it would make sense to have a late-filed exhibit with regard to the Class 2 survey, being that it was something specifically indicated as warranted by the SHPO. So,
I would concur.
Yeah.
May I ask a question? Would it be possible that if SHPO is satisfied with what's been provided to them as part of the Class 3 and does not no longer feel it's necessary to have a Class 2, could we also provide that as late filed in lieu of a report if it's not required?
That would be fine.
So I suppose...
I mean, from my perspective.
It'd be all right.
No, I concur.
Yeah.
Just something about...
Okay.
No point in having the SHPO satisfied. No point in having an opinion if it doesn't matter.
So...
Does this tie in with a previous exhibit? What was the reference to? What was the reference?
Yes.
At least in mind, it's the very last page of exhibit one. Judge, it's part of the application. There's a letter from SHPO dated August 17, 2011.
What we could do, though, is put it with late filed exhibit 9A, which is the SHPO concurrence, and then we either provide the concurrence, we provide any additional documentation to satisfy the request for Class 2 at that time.
Mr. Armstrong?
That's satisfactory to me.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. The only thing is, let's be sure that that we have it described. So 9A would now be the SHPO concurrence to report filed as Exhibit 9, actually, to the Class 3 cultural resource inventory report. And so what is the and going to be, Mr. Armstrong? Their further advice requirement for Class 2 cultural resource inventory.
I don't want to make it too long, Judge, but what I was thinking is it would either be their further advice whether one is warranted or not, and concurrence if one is warranted and completed.
All right. And further advice regarding... stay with me. I can't write as fast as you talk. Okay? And further advice regarding...
How about this? Further advice or concurrence regarding Class 2?
That will work.
All right, so then I have now Exhibit 9A, SHPO concurrence to report filed as Exhibit 9, the Class 3 Cultural Resource Inventory Report, and further advice or concurrence regarding Class 2 Cultural Inventory Report. Is that acceptable, Ms. Smith?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
Yes.
All right, that will be late filed Exhibit 9A, and I do mention, you know, you will see my exhibit list, and that'll be subject to review then, but in any event. Exhibit 9A as revised is received. Further questions from the Commission? Commissioner Clark.
Just a couple more. I think I understand, going back to the acoustic reports that were submitted, in the exhibit, there's a table that appears on each of the sheets within the exhibit. The table is the same on every page. Is that correct? It's just the map that's changing with the... So you've got acoustic modeling. This is within Exhibit 11. Sound contours, Vestas V90, Siemens 2.3101.
Yeah.
So, The table in each of those is the same table.
That's correct.
It's the map that's changing with
that's
regard
correct.
To the particular. Okay. And And then on the shadow flicker report, it would appear the highest, and I think this was in your testimony, the highest number of hours per year under the, is it the Ricker greenhouse? Is that a particular model that you were referring to?
Basically treating the house as being all glass, so any shadow that would touch the house anywhere on the house would be recorded.
Okay.
As part of that conservative assumption.
Got it. And this is a cumulative, this is a cumulative impact of the entire wind field. If all 60 some sites were
actually constructed using the largest turbine, which as I mentioned earlier would not actually be the case.
Okay. And same thing with the acoustic study. It's a study of the cumulative effect of the entire field, not an individual turbine.
That's correct.
Okay. Let me ask you sort of a pragmatic question with regard to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or maybe sort of a practical question with the back and forth with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As I understand it and have learned in past citing cases, and is indicated here, there's no slip of paper they give you. It's essentially a liability issue that the project developer is willing to take on as a matter of building the project. Is that right? Vis-a-vis the Endangered Species Act. And
that's correct. Yes. If there's no clear federal nexus and no reason for them to provide consultation under Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, there's no requirement for them to do so.
Okay. Is there any concern from just a liability standpoint and potential future marketing of the project itself that, I mean, some of the letters that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have sent here have been, and they're fairly strongly worded, encouraging you to use the 2003 model as opposed to the 2010 or 11 one, the one that hasn't quite been adopted yet. I mean, regardless of whether it's a, what weight this commission places on it, is there any concern from as a project developer that you may have a project that other utilities might be reluctant to invest in or be a party to if they feel like there's an outstanding liability because of the letters that you've received from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes.
Is there any way to, or have you explored ways to mitigate that risk? In other words, is there a way to go back and recreate it using the 2003 model, or is it such that it can't be recreated now that you're at this point? Does that make any sense?
We actually could. It would be a completely paper exercise, and it would have no value from a conservation standpoint, but we could spend money to do what the Fish and Wildlife Service is asking. But from my perspective, it doesn't make sense for us to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Cook.
Just a couple, actually. I thought of the same stream that Tony had, that the previous witness talked about maybe potential seller being TVA. Since there wasn't an EIS done because there wasn't a nexus, doesn't that automatically limit you can't sell to TVA or something like that, or can you still sell to them?
If we were to go to some potential off-take that would be a federal or quasi-federal entity that would involve some sort of federal action, then the project then would have to go through an environmental review under NEPA.
So even with but you wouldn't build it unless you had your cell. Okay, I'm tracking that. All right.
So yeah, it's conceivable, I guess, if TVA was the purchaser, we would have to go back or really start a NEPA environmental review process prior to construction in that case.
Okay, and then I just had a couple of just more general knowledge for me questions, I guess, that I read in some of the spin-up today about stormwater discharge permits. Is there going to be anything like that required for this project?
There is. Any construction project that it deserves.
I guess what's the limit? It used to be 1 acre, 5 acre, bounces around, it seems like.
Yeah, it's my understanding it's currently 1 acre.
And that's the state requirement. And then, okay. What is your definition of prime farmland? What do you use as your measurement of that? Yield on wheat? I mean,
no. There's actually specifically believe it's the Department of Agriculture that has a specific definition in how prime farmland is defined.
So you take the USDA definition as your definition?
We defined it as it's defined in the excluded areas within the commission's regulations.
Okay, thank you. That was all that I had.
Further questions from the commission? Follow-up, Ms. Smith?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Judge.
Mr. Merle?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Smith?
We have no further witnesses at this time.
And nothing further at this time?
We would reserve our right to call rebuttal following any public comments, but otherwise, no.
Of course. Mr. Armstrong, anything for the record?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Is there anyone, please, who wishes to speak to the commission, either to offer testimony or comment? Now is the time to do that. If you will just please come forward, have a seat, and away we go. Anyone? Is there anyone who wishes to address the commission? If not, then we'll proceed. Commission's closing comments. Commissioner Clark?
Just thank you all for being here, and again, reiterate my colleague's comments. Thanks to Verendry for making the facility available, and for all of the hospitality. I, in my opening comments, I talked about North Dakota for, 10 years ago was 50th in wind power. I failed to follow up on where we are now, though, which is North Dakota is now in the top 10 in wind production. I mean, with 1,400 megawatts, it vaulted us into that location. Perhaps as impressively, especially considering that we are a major electricity producing state, we're number two in terms of the percentage of power that comes from wind. I think Iowa may be the only one that's ahead of us in that regard. But it shows you just how, not only in oil and gas, which we hear about every day, but in wind power as well and alternative sources of energy, North Dakota has really become a major epicenter for development across the country. So it's through proceedings like this that type of development has happened, and hopefully you've gotten a better sense for today, the kind of questions that we ask and are looking out for as we do our due diligence in ensuring that the investment is done in the right way. So again, thank you for being here, and thank you for the hospitality.
Commissioner Kramer.
Well, I'll just say thank you as well, and again, I look forward to lunch. I guess that was just sort of a bonus on top of the coffee. Co-ops are like that, Bruce, aren't they? They just are so hospitable. So we appreciate that. I also, it's fun when you walk into a hearing room, and we have a lot of hearings. Sometimes there's nobody from the public there, and sometimes there are a lot of people from the public there. And so today there are a bunch of people from the public, and that means one of two things. There's either a lot of angry people or a bunch of people who want to make sure we don't screw this thing up. So hopefully we've met your expectation today, and good luck on the project. We hope it all turns out.
Commissioner Cook.
Just thank you for coming out today, and best of luck to Verendry as you continue to work hard and mine it over this winter season. So thank you all for coming out.
Thank you, commissioners. Ms. Smith, anything further for the record?
No, Your Honor.
And Mr. Armstrong, anything further for the record?
No.
Accordingly, the hearing in Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC, New Frontier Wind Energy Project, North Dakota Public Service Commission, case number PU-11-69, is closed, subject to the filing of late filed exhibits. Thank you very much, counsel.